Greetings, my friends, and welcome to The Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Few things have changed as much in the past decades as the institution of marriage. Our guest, Jonathan Rauch, is a staunch defender of marriage. He's also the author of Gay Marriage, Why It Is Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America. While others experiment with alternatives, Jonathan Rauch is perfectly content with a good old-fashioned I do. Why?
This is really not about sex or about gender. It's about coupledom. It's about the fact that the human heart needs marriage. For most people, that means someone of the opposite sex. For a small percentage of people, it means someone of the same sex. And ultimately, it's not the choice of gender that matters. It's to have and to hold, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, till death do you part, is what matters.
Jonathan Rauch is an advocate for everyone's right to marry if they choose to do so. In addition to his book, Gay Marriage, Mr. Rauch's previous books are about American public policy, culture, and economics. He's also a correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly, is a senior writer for the prestigious National Journal, and is writer-in-residence at the Brookings Institution. He is vice president of the Independent Gay Forum. Bill Russell and I found Mr. Rauch's defense of marriage interesting and wanted to know more, so we welcomed him to this conversation. Jonathan Rauch, I was meeting a friend for coffee not very long ago when, and I happened to be standing on a street corner, and a TV crew came up to me, and they said, "What do you think about what's going on in the legislature?" I said, "Well, I've been out of town. I don't know what's going on." They said, "Oh, this business about gays getting married." And I stood there and I looked at him in disbelief. I said, "So what's the question? Somebody objects to people getting married?" Well, he thought that I had come from the wrong planet. This notion that marriage should be objectionable, I found stunning. However, you have helped me to see that I am in a minority in this, and that the whole subject of marriage is one to be explored. How can anybody in America in the 21st century object to marriage?
Well, particularly when you remember that the big problem we have in this country isn't too many marriages, it's not too many people getting married or too many people staying married, it's too few people getting married and staying married, which is why I say to conservatives all the time, gay marriage isn't part of the problem, it's not an attack on marriage, it's part of the solution, it's part of the reinforcement of marriage.
Well, part of why I found this experience so funny was in the 60s, mothers would have given their right arms for people to want to get married.
Yes, and I look forward, Paula, to a day when mothers will tell their teenage children who are gay, you know, just grow up and get married. Like my Jewish grandmother, may her soul rest in peace, would have said, "Just get married." And I would have said, "Grandma," I was a kid, "I don't want to get married." "You should get married." That's the message to send.
The notion that marriage is so central to civilization, as you talk about it at some length in Gay Marriage, is one that I just had to stop and think about that. Your contention, your starting point is that marriage is central to civilization and that we need to be looking at marriage as an institution rather than arguing about who should get married.
Marriage is the bedrock institution of civilization. It's the ultimate civilizing force. And one of the great ironies of writing a book about gay marriage is I constantly encounter straight married people who are so used to the notion of marriage, they're like fish in water. They never think about its importance or think about it institutionally. They just go on about their business. And sometimes I find myself kind of explaining to them why this is such a special and unique institution and so worthy of privilege and of defense.
And what do you say?
Well, I say marriage is unique. It is the only promise that you'll make for life, and it is a promise not just between two people, but between the couple and their community. It's a promise to the community, and that's really special. That's what makes marriage what it is.
I thought when I started reading your book that, as is the case frequently with people who can't have something, it becomes more appealing. And in the early pages, I thought perhaps you were exaggerating the benefits, the social importance, the utility of marriage, and I give you credit. You sustain the notion long enough that you almost convinced me that that marriage really is a very, 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 very important social institution, as well as an institution or an important connection between two people. And I think particularly that social piece is the one that we tend to forget about. That this is a responsibility that we take on not only between two people, but it establishes a relationship, an important relationship with the community.
Where's your hesitation, Bill? You said almost convince you that it's very, very, et cetera, important. I'm just curious.
Well, that's a good question. I'm always equivocating just because I'm not, you know, certainty is a real challenge to me. Ask me that question
when
later.
We come back. We'll be back in a moment with Jonathan Rauch, who has written Gay Marriage, Why It Is Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America. Be with us when we return in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. We are delighted to have Jonathan Rauch with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell was talking about this whole...
I was avoiding answering your question.
I'll give you an opportunity here to avoid it a little longer. Jonathan, you say in Gay Marriage, you talk about how if two people go into the woods and they pledge their troth, they commit to each other, they can do that and it's fine, but it ain't marriage because the third party is always... The community is always central to that commitment, which will give you a chance to think a little longer, Bill.
Poor Bill looks a little desperate over there.
gasping.
This business of
thumbing through books, trying to find something.
Two people are not a marriage. Three is what a marriage makes. Spell that out a little
right.
more.
That's right. Three or more. Two people can do a lot of things, and if marriage were just a contract between two individuals, they could go off by themselves to a lawyer's office in the privacy of, with no one else around, they could make a deal.
Still, it's a lawyer's office.
Well, if it were not marriage, they could do it in private. They wouldn't need a lawyer. For marriage, there's always a third party present, even if it's only one person. Of course, usually it's tens, dozens, hundreds of people. It's your friends, your family.
It's your grandmother who makes sure of that, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And it's, of course, the parents who insist on the lavish weddings, not the kids. They'd often rather not bother with it in many cases. But that's all those people around you in your life, your friends and family and neighbor and community, all saying what you're doing today is really important and we all have a stake in this. A marriage only happens when two people make this promise in front of a witness. Who is the community? That person can be a clerk or a magistrate, or it can be dozens of people. But that's the crucial thing that makes marriage different. And Paula, you know, as I go around talking to people about the book, and one of the things I'm struck by again and again is how in America today, so many people take marriage for granted that they forgot that every marriage has an invisible third partner, and that's the community. And a lot of people these days think marriage is just a deal between two people. It's no one else's business. Why should anybody else care? It's just a private arrangement. Well, of course, my grandmother knew better than that.
I was once... Strange things happen on ski lifts because people have you captive for anywhere from 2 minutes to, you know, 30
too
minutes.
Long.
Unless, of course, the lift stops, in which case you're in deep trouble. But this person was making a point, and this goes back several years, that goes to what you're talking about. I said, you know, it just drives me crazy that kids go off to the end. You know, they have these exotic marriages. You know, they go to Fiji and stand on the beach, you know, up to their ankles in water and have a wedding ceremony that they've written and something and something. You know, and it was really exotic locations, I think.
Yeah, but it wasn't roller skates. You upped his story by one with roller skates.
Yeah. I made that up.
Well, there's probably an example somewhere, but his point was that what it does is separate that ceremony from the community of which these people are supposed to be a part. And it seems, I mean, this sort of goes to Robert Putnam, it seems that part of the challenge is that we have, in many, many ways, of which marriage is one, we have dissociated ourselves, the individual, from the communities of which they're a part.
Marriage today looks more like cohabitation than it used to, and cohabitation today looks more like marriage than it used to. And what you're talking about is part of that phenomenon, but despite that, marriage is still different for most people from anything else. I don't know if you ever watched Sex and the City, one of my favorite TV shows, but I think maybe it's the third season. There's a whole bit about how the protagonist, Carrie Bradshaw, is together with her boyfriend, whose name is Aiden, and they've been together. It's a successful relationship, same apartment, same life. They look married, they act married, but they finally break up because Aiden asks Carrie to marry him and she won't do it. She can't bring herself to make that commitment. And I know I've seen that situation in life. Many of us have. And what that's telling you is Americans still understand that when you go and you get married in front of all those people, even if the person is just a clerk, but usually it's a lot more, you're making a whole different kind of commitment. You're not just sanctifying or ratifying an existing relationship. You're entering a whole new phase of your life, a whole new stage, a whole new kind of being in the eyes of your community as well as each other.
I was struck at how deeply, and you step to it and say the same thing, how deeply conservative marriage is.
Uh-oh, the C word.
Well, but it is, if one thinks about it. It is conserving of a community in a way that is, there's nothing wrong with conserving things. I think we should conserve clean air. Maybe we should conserve marriage. But that, I must confess, had not occurred to me that anything that conservative, which isn't necessarily status quo, would be so powerfully important.
The case for gay marriage, Paula, this is the great irony, is a deeply conservative case in exactly that sense of the word. It's based on the notion that sex, love, and marriage go together, and that society is healthier when they do, and individuals are healthier, and couples are healthier, and neighbors are healthier. This is an idea that a lot of people have gotten away from in recent years, and of course it's social conservatives who've been reminding us what happens when fathers go AWOL and you have lots of childbirth out of wedlock and high divorce rate. So along come the gays who say, well, we want to go back to that notion of marriage as the ultimate commitment. We want the vows and the ceremonies and the rings and the rites and the responsibilities and the drudge work. And it's conservatives who are saying, no, you can't have that. It's too radical. It's a very funny kind of situation.
It would seem, I mean, it seems to me that's part of the challenge is, you know, we have, and I say, this is part of the answer to the question you ask. We have these neat little packages, these little boxes. We've got a conservative and
with a big C.
Either one. And if you are a conservative, everything fits in that box. And we have all these other concepts. And your book is a good examination of the objections, the logical objections that most people raise. It turns out that, as you say, most of these, you know, if you force it to the absolute logic, the logic is very thin. What it comes down to is people's feelings and attitudes, which are not subject, in many cases, to logical suasion. And it seems that it's that part that's extraordinarily difficult to deal with. You can't have an argument with somebody who won't argue with you. And some of the things we're talking about never get surfaced.
You know, Bill, that's right, but I don't complain about that. It makes my job as an advocate of same-sex marriage much harder to be dealing with a level at which a lot of people just say, look, all the arguments in the world won't change my mind. This is marriage we're talking about. It's always been man-woman for 3,000 years of at least of continuous Western civilization. And of course, that makes my job a lot harder and it's harder to argue with, but I actually treasure that because marriage is the bedrock of civilization. We don't want to toy with it lightly. It is a good impulse on the part of people to say we care enough about marriage, we take it seriously enough, not just in our heads but in our hearts, to be cautious about being rash with it. We've made mistakes in the past in this country, made reforms that seem to make sense, only to find out that they didn't work out so well. So what I try to do in the book and in my talks to people is make clear to them how seriously I take what we're doing here, that this book is written out of a sense that I really treasure marriage and what it stands for and don't want to do anything rash.
Well, and with due credit, you are not arguing, we should say this early on, for the Supreme Court to step in. You're not arguing in favor of a constitutional amendment. Either way. And it's a fairly persuasive argument, is that this should be done incrementally utilizing the federal system that we have available to us.
Spell out this business of why you would have all 50 states make their own decision about this so that there's flexibility in the system.
That's the hardest bullet for me to bite is when my gay friends say, You know, if you have it your way, we can get married in one state, and the minute we leave the state, we're not married anymore. What kind of marriage is that? And they say, isn't marriage a civil right that we should have everywhere right away? And I'm a gay man. I'm in a long-term relationship. There's nothing I'd like more than to wake up tomorrow in a world where I could get married in all 50 states. But it goes back to what Bill was saying just a moment ago. A few things, actually. One is, it's just not democratic. And I'm a small d Democrat, I think, all the way to the center of my being. It's just not democratic for one state and five judges to decide this fundamental question for the whole country. And people don't agree on gay marriage, and they won't for a while. So I think you've got to decide it democratically. Second is, we are talking about marriage. We're talking about something very important. We need to know if this is going to work, and it's only really going to work because marriage is a community-based institution. If gay marriage is accepted in its community instead of rejected as some kind of alien imposter that's been implanted from outer space. So what might happen if you had gay marriage imposed by the Supreme Court on Texas, or for that matter, possibly in Georgia? So plant the seed in soil that's receptive. Try it in a few states, and let's find out what happens. What we're going to find out, I'm convinced, is that this works. This makes for stronger communities, not weaker communities. Stronger marriage, not weaker marriage. It bolsters the expectation that everyone will get married. And then we'll find out it works, and the rest of the country, I think, will come along with enthusiasm over time.
And marriage has always been based in the states.
Always.
This is from the beginning of...
Before the country was a country. In colonial days, marriage was always up to the separate colonies, and there's a reason for that. Not just marriage, by the way, domestic law. Domestic law comes closest to the cores of our beings. It touches the social issues that are hardest for us to agree upon. You know, how should our families be structured? What should our daily lives be like? We're not talking about securities law or buying and selling. We're talking about families. And the principle has always been that those things that affect us closest to be home should be legislated closest to home, and that's a good principle.
This is Jonathan Rauch. We'll be back with him in a moment here on the Paula Gordon Show. We trust you'll be with us when we return. Jonathan Rauch is our guest here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I have had the pleasure of reading Gay Marriage, What is Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America. Let's go back a little bit, if you would, to this business about the domestic law is based in the communities, and particularly in the states. As I was reading Gay Marriage, I kind of went, oh yeah, okay, well, no big deal, Vermont does it. No, Vermont doesn't do that. There's a difference between civil marriage and civil union, and the state of Massachusetts is in the process of saying gay marriage will happen for the first time in America. But if you would distinguish what you call marriage light, the not married marriages that include civil union, how do you distinguish what is and what isn't marriage?
You know, Paula, the very question is actually, in a way, the answer to itself. People ask me all the time, well, what is a civil union exactly? The very fact that you have to ask tells you people don't understand right off the cuff what this means, and there's a reason for that. Civil union was invented basically 3 or 4 years ago as a concept. It can mean anything from basically full-fledged marriage for gay people with all of the legal rights that a state, not the federal government, can confer, to something much more like a domestic partnership registry, which confers some rights and obligations but is much easier to get out of. It can be a whole range of packages. What's unique about marriage is when people see that ring on your finger, they know what it is that you have promised to do.
Even if they don't know what it is that you promised to do.
Well, but they do know. They know that you're going to be there for that person. They know you have made the commitment that your job in life, regardless of how many radio shows you do or your business consulting career, if something happens to Bill over here, if he gets hit by a bus, God forbid, tomorrow morning, they know who to call, and they know that you will drop everything to deal with it. That's what marriage says to your community, and that's what allows your community to say to you, well, you've made that commitment, you get the status, the benefits, and the obligations that go with it. And only marriage has that unique demarcating feature. Civil unions can be just about anything, but it's really not clear that they bring all the benefits or all the obligations.
I was amused at the idea that 3 to 5 to 7 to 10,000 years of human history, marriage pitted against the HR department of some large corporation, not marriage. The benefits versus the rights that come with marriage, not marriage.
Well, one of the other reasons I live in an upside-down world when I talk about gay marriage is you would think that political conservatives, capital C conservatives, would be the last people to be trying to invent substitutes and alternatives to marriage. You know, there's something called, I don't know if you've heard of this, the alternatives to marriage movement. It's basically a left-wing phenomenon, and it's people who say government shouldn't pick winners and losers, it should be neutral about our lifestyle, so marriage shouldn't have any special privileges. Anybody in any kind of relationship should be entitled to whatever benefits they want. So they want to create lots of alternatives to marriage as a way of knocking marriage off its pedestal. Well, oddly enough, politics makes strange bedfellows. Their allies in this turn out to be opponents of gay marriage on the right, who have what I call the ABM Pact, not anti-ballistic missile, but anything but marriage. Give the gays something, just don't call it marriage. Well, here's the problem. You've got conservatives, of all people, trying to set up alternatives to marriage, substitutes for marriage, marriage light, things which, as you set them up, will over time be open to heterosexual couples as kind of halfway houses to marriage. Or even if they're not, they send the message marriage is just one of a lot of interchangeable lifestyle options. It's not the way to go. It's not good for marriage to be creating alternatives.
There were, stepping back and looking at your book, trying to just extract, what did I see that is the, you know, sort of the essence? And there were two things that came, that jumped out at me. One is that through all these arguments, a lot of it comes down to people who don't think that gay people really have a right to exist, and that it represents moral failure or any one of a thousand different things. But that, you know, all the arguments aside, that they're just deep down inside, they think it is unnatural, inappropriate, wrong, and they will not allow, so far as they can control it, anything that will endorse gay people. That's one.
We call that bigotry in other contexts.
One could easily call it that. The other one that jumped out at me is that the if you will, the existential argument description, actually, it's not even an argument, that there is this reality that most of the rest of the people, and it seems that that's part of the dividing line, have acknowledged that there really is this group of people who we call gay, that are real, they're tangible, they exist, and they ain't going away. And that acknowledgement is a fairly new phenomenon. And it seems to me that's really the fundamental dividing line. And then above that is the, you know, then how do you deal with those conditions?
You got those two groups, and that's, you're absolutely right, Bill. That's essential. But there's a third group, and they're the group that I'm really trying to talk to in this book. And there are a lot of these people in America. These are people who have come to accept that gay people are really here and really gay, that for whatever reason we are this way, it's not chosen, it's not changeable, it's not pathological, and it's not a threat to anybody else's family. And they've got their minds around that, especially if they're under the age of 50. But what they can't get their minds around is the notion that marriage somehow can be changed by fiat to not being about a man and a woman. For somebody who says homosexuality is wrong, period, you shouldn't do it, they shouldn't get married, and in fact, gay people should get off the planet.
They shouldn't exist. Right?
Shouldn't exist. Don't care what happens to us gay people. Don't care if we're locked out of the hospital rooms. Don't care if we lose our homes. Don't care if we spend our lives in devoted relationships and then can't even get into the same country with the person. If somebody just says, I really couldn't care less, get off the planet, there's not a whole lot I can say to them. But what's been so profoundly moving to me as an American, not just a gay American, but an American, has been discovering straight America is really wrestling with the morality of this question. A lot of people who 10 years ago would have said, gay marriage, that's absurd, it's a contradiction in terms, are really thinking it over. And a lot of people are saying, well, I can't go the whole way, but let's talk about civil unions. They're really thinking about the welfare and the happiness and well-being of their gay fellow citizens, even if they don't go all the way to gay marriage. And I got to say, you know, that's to me, coming as a 43-year-old gay American, that's a very powerful and moving testament to the, I think, something very right about people in our country.
There's an interesting twist that you bring to mind for me, that gay marriage, you say, would be the end of gay liberation, that it would be the next step past liberation to rights.
And responsibility.
How does that work?
This is beyond the gay rights agenda, and as Bill said, this is the beginning, really the culmination of the gay responsibility agenda. I would never have believed this if you had told me 10 or 15 years ago, but it turns out that getting people to accept the notion of gay responsibility is harder than gay rights. A lot of people will say anti-discrimination laws, okay, fine. But child rearing, serving your country in the military, and marriage, those remain the three hotspots, and what they all involve are saying that gay people are of sufficient standing in their nation and their community and responsible enough to look after other people, to shoulder these fundamental burdens. And of course, marriage is the most fundamental of all. Part of what's been, you know, people talk about on the right, always talk about with disparagement, the homosexual lifestyle. You know, too much partying, too much sex, too unstable, too unhealthy. Well, if you take a population and you ban marriage, you even ban open relationships, you're going to get a lot of sex in the bushes. What we're moving toward here is a responsibility climate culture, you know, a culture of responsibility.
You also talk about how that kind of treatment permanently locks people into being, I think your word is infantilized, that if you tell people they can never grow up, they'll never grow up.
It warps the personality. It even warps the soul at some level. Something I try to talk about in the book is to talk to gay people as well as straight people. Some people on the gay left have always been uncomfortable with the notion of gay people getting married because their agenda was to liberate us from bourgeois norms like marriage. And my agenda is very different. Of course, if people don't want to get married, that's their prerogative. But in some way, there's a deeper kind of liberation that comes from making that ultimate sacrifice to someone else. And that's what allows you to grow up, knowing from childhood that there's a destination for love, something beyond infatuation, something beyond sex, you know, a real commitment, turning love into life.
Jonathan Rauch, our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show. We'll all be back in a moment. Please be with us. This is The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted to have Jonathan Rauch with us. He has written about gay marriage, why it is good for gays, good for straights, and good for America. And you've written about a lot of other things as well over the course of your 20-something years as a journalist. This idea that you can go to something that's so tender in the American social milieu, if you will, and try to argue reasonably about something that is so emotional. Are you helping us to grow up? You talked about getting beyond childhood with the homosexual ability to grow up and take a big commitment. Aren't you also talking about American society having a chance to move beyond being infantilized?
Well, I don't know about grow up, but I guess I think the answer is yes, though I'd put it a little differently. I think I mentioned earlier that to straight America, marriage is like water and married couples are like fish in the water. And what I hope to do is to get straight people to think harder about why they have marriage, why it's so special, what it means, why it has to change over time as society changes, and why we've reached one of those junctures now. And yes, there is the further element that at a very fundamental level, what's happening here is gay couples, as couples, stepping forward and saying, we hold America to the promise of the Declaration of Independence. All men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And these couples are saying there is nothing more essential to the pursuit of happiness than the ability to choose someone, marry them, and make a home and a family with them. That is so essential to our well-being that part of America's maturation is to extend that opportunity to all Americans, not lock anybody out.
I think it was Malcolm Gladwell that said it the most clearly. He was talking about, I don't even remember the context, the married people. And he said that frequently someone will say when a spouse dies that I feel like a part of me is dead. And he said that is technically correct, that we become so dependent on those people that we share our lives with. Just in technical things, I don't know where the checkbook is. I don't know how to find this. I don't even think about a whole range of things. And in fact, his argument is that it is technically true that when someone you have that close, long-term, binding relationship with goes away, then a substantial portion of who you are in the community, as well as to yourself, goes away.
Absolutely. Your identity, personal as a couple and as part of the community, are bound up in marriage, and it is a fact, undisputed, in over 100 years of social science. Married people are happier, they are healthier, they are more prosperous, they are more stable, they live longer, they have less dependency, less depression, less crime, on that, whether they have kids or whether they don't have kids. And even after you adjust for all the variables that might mess up the comparisons, this remains true. Marriage is essential to the well-being, to the fulfillment of life's promise for many people. And it actually makes us better people because it wraps us in this web of community and family. That's what marriage is unique about. Marriage takes people not related by blood or tribe or even nationality necessarily, and it makes them family. It makes them kin. Nothing else that we know of, not civil unions or domestic partnerships or cohabitation or anything else that we know of, can really do that.
Yeah, this wonderful line that one of society's big challenges is to, I don't remember the word you used first, but to domesticate young men. And that if one were to look at all kinds of lifestyle questions, if you didn't give young men the opportunity and obligation through marriage to be settled, that this is a real function, and again, it goes back to what you're talking about with the lifestyle issues that some people find objectionable, that giving homosexuals, men and women, lesbian and gay men, a chance to have marriage would have a really settling effect. This notion of domesticating people I found quite charming.
Yeah, well, it's a peculiar word to use because people think about house training for animals, and that's not the notion at all. But it's marriage is... When you come of age, marriage is how you build a home. It's how you create a place where someone's waiting for you who's going to be there. Your home is where your marriage is. That's how you start young people in life and you stabilize them, you make them part of your community. People often say, I'm surprised you haven't said it yet. Isn't marriage for procreation? The answer to that is no. Sex is for procreation. Marriage is for creating family. And you need family whether you have kids or you don't have kids or you're young or you're old. Young people need marriage as a way to get started in life. Old people need marriage because of health problems and vulnerability. And people in the middle need marriage so that they can have someone to fall back on in life and look after them and be there for them for life's contingencies.
And then there is love. And you make a good argument that marriage is not for love, that love may be part of marriage, but that it isn't necessarily... the reason for marriage.
People always accuse me of taking much too idealistic a view of marriage in this book, Paula, and in fact, the opposite is the case. And here's why. Marriage begins with love, and that's a crucial element. As Benjamin Franklin said, where there is marriage without love, there will be love without marriage. No dummy, Ben Franklin.
and he had experience thereof.
But what's unique about marriage is it keeps the relationship going even on the bad days when sex, infatuation, and romantic love aren't enough or in some cases aren't there anymore. It changes love into something deeper, a kind of long-term trust. And all those community expectations, not wanting to disappoint your parents, your in-laws, your neighbors, and knowing that you need to do the right thing, doesn't ensure that the marriage will hold up. Heaven knows lots of marriages end in divorce. But it does help keep people going for each other in those rough patches when if they split up, they may live to regret it. And if they stay together and they work through it, I think we all know couples like this. They come out the other side and they're better for it.
Go ahead.
You know, you don't make a point of it, but listening to you, the social piece is obviously very important, but it would also seem, particularly in the noisy world we inhabit, that those vows themselves are of very high significance, and the fact that they're done publicly and they have some legal standing, I think, is part of it. But those the words that are typically used in a marriage are, you know, it's pretty heavy stuff. When you hear those words coming out of your mouth, I think that's one of the reasons people tend to cry at weddings. Is, you know, those are very serious commitments, and most people, I think, do not make those kinds of commitments lightly. And it seems that personal piece of it, for each individual involved in it, as well as the social piece, is also very important.
Absolutely. There are really three pieces that make marriage what it is. One is the legal piece, the fact that it's hard to get out of because you'll go to a divorce court and all the benefits and burdens and obligations. The second is the social piece, which we've been talking about. Those are all the expectations of friends and families and the ceremonies. The third piece is just the reciprocity, standing there in front of all those people and saying to one other person, you're it. We're there for each other. That's a very, very unique moment in everybody's life.
We haven't talked specifically about children. It isn't just the question of is marriage for procreation. It is also the reality, and we have a number of gay friends who have adopted children. The children are in this mix, and the children may be the biological offspring of one of the partners within a union. They may be adopted. There are lots of ways that can happen. And there are the nieces and the nephews and all of the other children. The whole question of the younger generation and how, A, people relate to them in their own nuclear families, and then, B, how do you deal with all of these kids who are coming up, who are our future, in terms of how homosexual people should be treated and how a family is. So this question about the children is you don't treat that in any way lightly, and it's one that you call us to really pay some attention to.
The nexus between marriage and children is so important, and there is no doubt that creating a stable, secure environment for children is one of the ways in which marriage is just irreplaceable. We don't know of anything on average that's remotely as good. Of course, single mothers can do just fine, and their kids often do just fine. But in terms of the averages and the statistics, marriage really is something special for kids. And of course, as you said, many gay couples now have kids, sometimes natural kids, by an earlier marriage, for example. According to the 2000 census, 28% of same-sex partnered households are raising kids. And I often say to my conservative friends, why would you want those kids to grow up with unmarried parents? For that matter, having gay couples modeling the behavior of marriage is good for the kids of the straight couple next door. You want the kids to grow up in a neighborhood where the model of a committed relationship is marriage, and where you can say to your kids, when you grow up and fall in love, you'll get married. You see the Mrs. Smith and Mr. Smith on the left, and Mr. Jones and Mr. Jones on the right, they're all married. That's what you should do. That strengthens marriage. It's good for kids.
Jonathan Rauch has written about these and many other related subjects in Gay Marriage, Why It Is Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America. Bill Russell joins me in inviting you to be with us when we come back. Welcome back. Jonathan Rauch is with us here on The Paula Gordon Show. In addition to gay marriage, you have also written about other things, particularly political things, including things like government's end, why Washington stopped working. I am interested to know just sort of the short course of all of these things that you have written about over many years. What brings you at this moment in your journalistic life to be so targeted on gay marriage?
Well, I'll tell you a little secret, Paula. I've been writing and thinking about marriage since well before I was writing and thinking about gay marriage. I come at this as someone who in the 80s was writing on social policy and economics in Washington and coming to learn, as was not well known back then, that a lot of our crime problems and family problems in America, I'm sorry, a lot of our crime and poverty problems in America are really marriage problems and family problems in disguise. The biggest single factor has been the breakdown of marriage, particularly in minority communities, the absence of fathers, and the family crisis that's ensued, particularly for children. So having done that for years and become sold on the importance of marriage and family, it was only natural in the 90s to say, well, gay marriage is part and parcel of the same ethic, that building stronger families builds stronger communities. What's so hard to get about that? Here's an opportunity to strengthen those values in America, which is why I think it's the trifecta of social policy, gay marriage. It's a win-win-win, good for gays and for straights and for marriage.
And I'm sitting here thinking about Randall Kennedy, who's written about...
Interracial intimacies is what he calls his big book about...
For a long time, marriage between different so-called races was illegal, and we seem to have more or less come to accept that, though part of the reason he's writing the book is it's a challenge. But a lot of his concern is about adoption, and I think of Marianne Mason, who's written about adoption. And one of the benefits of this discussion, it seems to me, is the opportunity to re-examine and perhaps revivify that institution that you started out thinking about and writing about, and it's, you know, how it should work, how it can work, and what we can do as a community, a political community, but also an inhabited community, to strengthen those institutions that, as you point out, have real value and are very important to a well-functioning political entity, community.
People often say to me, Bill, well, civil unions, if they're just like marriage, except we don't call them marriage and they're only for gay people, and so straight people can't do them instead of marriage, isn't that all right? And I say, well, I guess as a second choice, a distant second choice, that might be passable, but here's the problem with that. It walks away from a golden opportunity to send the most powerful signal that this country could possibly send of recommitment to the value of marriage as the gold standard for committed relationships. And really, we shouldn't walk away from that opportunity when we finally get one after 30 years of soaring divorce rates and 1 in 3 American children now born out of wedlock and Britney Spears getting married for 54 hours. Here is at last a chance to strike a big step in the other direction.
As you're talking about the family element, expanding on that a little bit, if we were to begin to, you really forced me to think about marriage in ways that I just don't usually, as you say, it's that... fish in water phenomenon. But if we were, I think there is also a danger to say, yeah, it's the gold standard, and are we forcing something? I mean, it's worth at least exploring. Are we forcing something whose time has passed?
That's something, you know, I heard a good bit of in Canada where I was yesterday. I was on a TV show being interviewed by a interviewer maybe 31, 32. In Canada, you get all the rights of marriage just by cohabiting for 3 years. It's the same, legally. And his view, a common one in his generation in Canada, is who needs marriage anyway? Why marriage? Why even bother? And what I say to that is, beyond all the reasons that marriage is special and irreplaceable, at least in America, we should prefer it. We shouldn't force anybody to get married, and we certainly shouldn't spit on people who, for whatever reason, don't get married or can't get married. But here's the thing. We prefer marriage because people who get married make a special bargain with their community. They undertake special obligations. If you're married, you've got to be there for Bill. If somebody asks you at your workplace, how's Bill? How's your husband? You can't say, I don't know. How should I know?
You can't, but...
That would not be looked upon well. What you do when you get married is stand before your community and say, I undertake this special burden for life. And people who do that need some special tools and rewards to make that commitment. So we're not discriminating in favor of a class of people. We're helping. We're making a reciprocal bargain between couples and their communities, which is a special kind of bargain.
Find myself thinking of quantum mechanics listening to you.
Only Bill would think of quantum mechanics
for,
in this
for
context.
Reasons I will try to make clear. Quantum mechanics partly deals with different energy states, and what you, the way you describe the Canadians and the way you describe the alternative is a continuum. And what you're describing with marriage is an energy state that is dramatically different and is, in fact, distinguishable from everything else. And your argument is that that continuum can lead to lots of problems, social problems, for which there is some evidence that the absence of marriage, I am now tangled up in my sentence.
There goes your metaphor.
But that it'll be bad. And that, those quantum states, single married, have that energy state.
That's right.
Does things in the environment that would not be done otherwise.
That's right. Marriage does not just ratify an existing relationship. It fortifies the relationship. It changes and deepens the relationship by bringing the couple into a whole new status in society and a whole new stage of life. That's why Carrie Bradshaw in Sex and the City couldn't bring herself to get married. It wasn't that she'd have to move in with the guy. She was already living with him. It's that this tells the world it's a whole new stage of life, a new kind of being in adulthood. And providing that mystique and that power about marriage is a lot of how it helps bind couples together. And when you make it just one of a lot of alternatives, you risk losing that.
That change, you have a wonderful line that marriage is the only thing that makes strangers into kin. That kind of power, you just wouldn't think of as simply an institution within a society. But you maintain with great strength that it is that kind of unique within civilization.
It doesn't always work. And this is not to romanticize it and idealize it and say if you get married, all your problems are solved and divorce will never happen. But it sure is the only thing we know of that reliably works remotely as well as it does to create family.
Those kinship ties, and you know, I too was struck by that, that's how it happens. There's this magical, mystical portal you go through, and there's...
One side you is, and one side you ain't.
A kinship relation established. And a lot of the world's troubles come from kinship relationships.
Yeah.
We shouldn't oversell that. But you go to a place that I find interesting, and it's perfectly consistent, that all the benefits that we talk about that include insurance and all the other things that go with it, you're willing to say that with gays being allowed to marry, that it makes sense for the culture to say these benefits go with marriage, period, because it's fair. Is that a reasonable representation of what?
Yes. Rule number one for marriage. Rausch's rule for marriage. Everybody listening here? If you want the benefits of marriage, you have to get married.
Sounds a lot like my mother a long time ago. And there's a reason for that.
There is a reason for that. You need that clear line so that everybody has a good sense of who has made that special promise, who has stepped up to the plate, and who therefore gets the special status and the special privileges and, of course, the special burdens and obligations that go with that.
Doesn't that make your sale somehow harder?
You know, I guess it doesn't so far. Does it ring wrong to you? Does it make you more scared or intimidated by marriage?
No, I was thinking really about trying to make this hard argument, and then you add on to that you're also going to tell people if they don't get married, they can't have the benefits, and there are a lot of people.
That's the quantum state.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you've got that clear distinction, which I think sometimes can be very helpful, and I think that's what you're arguing for.
I also want to hearken back. You talk in a way that I just hadn't thought before about 700 years of a dark ages for homosexuals.
Some people would say 1700 for that matter.
A long time. And this as a coming out party, if you will, no pun intended, I find remarkable.
It is such a privilege to be alive at this moment, Paula. I remember so vividly, maybe September 1995, not even 10 years ago, a conversation where my father told me, he advised me not to write about gay marriage. Not because of his position on the issue, but because I would marginalize myself as a writer if I even wrote about such a wacko idea. It was never going to happen. It was never even going to be taken seriously. And here is the American public deeply engaged with gay marriage, with homosexual couples, and with marriage itself in a way we haven't seen before after 700 or 1700 years of sweeping homosexuality under the carpet. And it's a fantastic moment to be here. It's a historic moment.
And in this historic moment, we're delighted to have Jonathan Rauch with us. We'll be back in a moment for a few more minutes of the Paula Gordon Show. We're here for a few more minutes with Jonathan Rauch on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell pointed out, as we were in the break, that in fact it is easy to act in the words that we have used as if all homosexual people are male. And the linguistics around this sometimes get tangled. I think of gay as male, homosexual as everybody, and lesbian as female. You're arguing that anybody who wants to get married should be able to get married however they are born.
Everyone should have the opportunity to marry. Exactly. One of the reasons this tends to get wrapped up in male homosexuality is society seems more frightened of gay men than of lesbian partners. And they're
Why
more worried
that?
About promiscuity
is
and
that?
So forth. And you'll hear people say gays shouldn't be married because they're too promiscuous, conveniently omitting the fact that something like half of gay couples are lesbian couples who are, if anything, more stable
and
less promiscuous than straight couples.
Promiscuity does not keep straight couples from being married.
Absolutely. That's right. 20% of American husbands say they've committed adultery, and those are just the ones who've admitted to it.
I didn't mean to get you off track. The question of lesbian partners.
All the same arguments apply. This is really not about sex or about gender. It's about coupledom. It's about the fact that the human heart needs marriage. For most people, that means someone of the opposite sex. For a small percentage of people, it means someone of the same sex. And ultimately, it's not the choice of gender that matters. It's to have and to hold, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and health, till death do you part, is what matters.
Part of my concern, to answer the question you asked a long time ago, is that you present reasoned arguments about what will or can happen in the future, which is always a concern. Prediction's easy. Correct predictions is a much more difficult challenge. And I give you credit. You address that by the incremental approach that you're suggesting in this political environment, rather than having an act of Congress or an amendment to the Constitution or a decision by the Supreme Court, that we incrementally use the tools that we have, which is to experiment on a state-by-state basis.
Yes. It's not just whether we have gay marriage that counts. It's how we get there. It's can we get there without breaking the furniture and the crockery? And America, among all the nations of the developed world, may be unique in having a system that is almost perfectly designed to get this right, to try it in the places where it's most likely to succeed, and then if it works, let it spread, let it prosper. Organic social change is always the best way to do it if you can, or almost always the best way to do it.
The idea of learning from experience seems to be somewhat outside of the last 40 years of experience in this country, where we'll often have a big solution and impose it.
Well, we did that with abortion. And this is a controversial view, but my feeling was that having a national abortion rights policy was a mistake because it set off 30 years of ongoing backlash, which isn't going away, and it's infected every Supreme Court, in fact, every judicial nomination. It set off a culture war which isn't going to end. If we hadn't had national imposition by the Supreme Court, abortion would be legal in virtually every state of the union, maybe one or two exceptions. And people who really felt strongly would be able to live in those states and have a moral community to their liking. And that's probably much better politically and socially than where we are now.
But if we hadn't had Brown versus the Board of Education, we might still have segregated schools. Although, we now have segregated schools. Wait a minute. The complexity of this is not to be diminished.
Correct. And there are no easy answers. And there are no zero-risk solutions on any side of this.
Part of the benefit of your suggestion is that instead of planting our feet firmly in one place and yelling at one another, which seems to be the standard model, that we at least go out and do some experiments.
Yes, absolutely. And we can.
And perhaps we must. Jonathan Rauch, we thank you for doing the work and thinking hard about what is for many people a difficult subject. We are pleased that you've been with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Jonathan Rauch's book is called Gay Marriage, Why It Is Good for Gays, Good for Straights, and Good for America. We thank him for caring so much about getting from love to life and for being our guest. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.